MacCast, Friday, December 30th, 2011. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast, probably the last MacCast of the season. I'm fairly safe in saying that, considering we're about, just less than 48 hours away from the new year going into 2012. I am excited to be finishing out the year with some good Mac news and tips and rumors and stuff to talk about. But before we dive into all of that, let's take a quick moment and thank one of our show sponsors, Smile. Smile Software makes a ton of great applications. I use a lot of them, but this time of year, there's one in particular that I will turn to. You know, I've talked about the fact that I don't burn discs too much anymore, DVDs. But at the end of the year here, what I like to do is do all of my end of the year archiving. And when I do that, Smile Software makes Disc Label, which is a program for printing out and designing labels for your CD, ROMs, DVDs, and things like that. And it comes in very handy for organizing all of that stuff. So at the end of the year, I burn off all of my important documents, projects that I've been working on, my yearly photo archives. So I've talked about the process that I go into iPhoto at the end of the year. I use a smart folder for the year and then burn off each year's worth of content to a couple of discs, take one that I put off-site, and also my movie purchases from iTunes, because you can't re-download those yet, and podcasts. You know, I also have it backed up in other places, but I like to have that physical sort of media that I know is there and often another safe location, just an extra backup. And I think it's really important. And, you know, using a Sharpie to just write some cryptic title on that, yeah, that might work, but that doesn't really tell you what's on there. And what's great about Disc Label is in a few extra minutes, you can design a really nice label. You can even do a tray insert if you have some of the hard plastic cases, so you can do the little slide-in card. It prints all of that stuff, all with the same design, and you can put a lot of detail on there. You can actually list out files that are in there, or different folders that are in there, the different types of content, and they offer a bunch of different printing options. You can print to paper labels that you print out on your inkjet. You can do direct printing if your printer supports that. They even have LightScribe support if you have one of the LightScribe devices, which I've always kind of wanted because I thought it'd be really convenient just to be able to, you know, laser on the label. And they support that, and they have really nice designs and templates that make it quick and easy to do, so you don't have to worry about design. If you want to design your own, you can certainly break out and do that. You can save off those projects. It has full iLife media integration. That means you can use photos from iPhoto to design your labels. You can put in track and chapter data if you're doing DVDs or iTunes playlists, if you want to burn mixed CDs. You know, those could be fun. And another great application is if you want to share your holiday photos with friends and family, you can print them out to a disc, you know, put them on a disc that somebody could take and to a photo processing place and get printed out. But before you hand it to them, you can print a nice label and have a really nicely designed item that you can pass along to them. And it's, you know, it gives it that extra little bit of polish that I think is really great. And the software makes it really easy. They have free trials available on their website, so you can check it out before you buy. And you can get more information and details over at smilesoftware.com. A big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. So usually this time of year, you know, things slow down in terms of the Apple and Mac news. I think we have a lot of rumors this week, but some information, some new products coming out from Intel and stuff like that. The first thing I wanted to talk about is these rumors of the Apple-branded TV, the iTV, whatever you want to call it, the actual television set that everybody thinks is going to be Apple's next big breakthrough revolutionary product. And they're saying now that it's going to be powered by some custom Apple silicon. Apple's going to build a custom chip for it. Supposedly lined up to do the manufacturing is Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company, TSMC, Advanced Semiconductor Engineering, ASE, Silicon Precision Industries, SPIL. They all have these little acronyms, I guess, or abbreviations. I don't know what you call those. They're all reportedly in the bidding to build Apple's next generation processors. I'm assuming Samsung may also be in the mix, although you have to think that Apple's trying to give them the boot as much as possible. But Apple's upcoming A6 and A7 processors are supposedly already being lined up to be produced by Taiwan Semiconductor using their new 28 nanometer to 20 nanometer processing technologies. And this is according to DigiTimes. I think a lot of the rumors these days are coming out of DigiTimes, and it's probably serves us to remember that DigiTimes is sort of hit and miss on a lot of this stuff. So it's not really clear if the Apple TV set will actually use the same A6, A7 processors, or if some sort of new design will be developed. Samsung and Sharp are supposedly lined up to manufacture not only chips, but displays for the new sets. And Foxconn is supposedly lined up to actually do the manufacturing of the first round of hardware. Now, some details started coming out regarding time frame and size. Apple supposedly is going to introduce these TVs near the end of 2012. But things get a little dicey when the rumors start talking about sizes, because they're saying Apple's going to produce 32-inch and 37-inch televisions. And if you look at the current TV landscape, that seems pretty small. You know, most people are going 42 inches and up when you're talking about an HD TV set. So when I heard these sizes, I thought, well, maybe Apple's going to do some sort of LCD display. You know, one of my theories had been that Apple might just put out a display that also does television, so you could hook it to your Mac or have it be a standalone TV with AirPlay support, and you could drive iOS content from your iPhones, your iPod touches to that. 37-inch seems like it might be almost too big for a desktop display. So it's this weird kind of in-between size, but that's where the current rumors are pointing. And chances are it's going to be a premium price on that. So I think Apple's going to be hard-pressed to compete unless there's something revolutionary, like they're saying about the software, with televisions that size. But we're going to have to see. On the content side, Apple Insider and Forbes are reporting that Apple is likely planning to launch some sort of a la carte live television programming services along with this, assuming they can get content deals done. These rumors are coming about because Apple's reportedly in talks with a lot of the content providers trying to shore that part of it up. The packages would reportedly offer the ability to mix and match not only channel packages, but also show packages, which is kind of the thing that I would be excited about. I've always said that the problem with the television industry right now is most of us watch shows. We don't really, I don't think about what channel it's on or what provider it's coming from. I just know I like this show and I like that show. And if I could buy some sort of package that allowed me to mix and match the shows that I like and pay a monthly subscription fee for that, I think that would be awesome. The reports are saying, though, that kind of mixing and matching really complicates licensing, and the studios themselves are worried about disrupting some of their existing cable deals with the cable providers. It's my understanding when you do a cable deal, there's kind of payments back from the cable companies to the content providers to get exclusive content and stuff like that. So there's a lot of value to the studios in that. So Apple's going to have to kind of break through that and show that they can deliver a system and hardware and software solution that is going to beat what's currently offered by the cable providers. So certainly an uphill battle, I think, for Apple on the content side, but some interesting things happening. And I'm still curious about the hardware and whether or not there's anything Apple can do revolutionary related to television hardware. A lot of people are talking about voice control. That seems a bit odd to me. But again, I've been proven wrong so many times by Apple and their engineers and their talent. They will put out something that, you know, on the surface when you hear these rumors sounds like it's kind of crazy. But when you actually see their implementation and how they've thought it through, it becomes this revolutionary thing and shakes up industries. So, you know, I probably poo-pooed the iPhone way back when, and if you went back and listened, I'm sure I was proven wrong on some things when Apple finally came out with the device. And so it does seem like the next frontier is television. We're going to have to wait and see, probably in mid-late 2012 when Apple actually throws something on the table. In recent weeks, we've been getting some inklings and some rumors about Intel's next generation processors and the timeline for those coming out. It's expected that Intel will have Ivy Bridge 22 nanometer processors finding their way into Apple hardware this spring around April. The 38, 3720QM and the 3720QM are i7 CPUs, and they're expected to show up in revved versions of the MacBook Pro. They also have some quad-core i5 and i7 desktop processors that are expected to juice up the iMac lines, and there are even some quote-unquote Ultrabook processors that would reportedly make their way into next-generation MacBook Airs. The lineup is expected to bring up to 199% improvement in graphics-intensive processes on desktops, and overall should bump the performance on Mac units about 25% when it comes to CPU operations. The next-generation CPUs would also require less power, resulting in better battery life, which is always a good thing. And in addition, there's some rumors saying that with at least some of the processors, Apple could bring out support for 4K video, which I think would go along with some of the rumors we've been hearing about Apple wanting to bump up some of the Mac displays to some sort of Retina quality. So you're going to have to drive a lot of pixels to very high-density displays in the future, and it looks like Intel's lineup should fall in line to make that happen. So we'll see if we get some new MacBook processors starting in the spring. Now, I wouldn't expect to see a next-generation iPhone until next fall, and that sort of yearly cycle for Apple to go through. So is it too early to have some iPhone 5 rumors? Well, a lot of the sites that are out there don't seem to think so. Boy Genius Report claims that they have sources that say there's going to be an aluminum-backed version of the iPhone out this fall. The front supposedly will have this kind of rubberized bezel that's going to hide a new antenna design and get around the fact that the aluminum back would not be very radio transparent. So just an early rumor, not many more details than that, but I think it's pretty safe to assume that we'll have a new iPhone next year. Moving a little bit closer in the future rumor timeline is the iPad 3 rumors, and those continue to spill out from various sources, most of them being the DigiTimes. They're saying that there's going to be a double-sized battery coming to the iPad 3, a 1400 milliamp version. That is versus the 6500 milliamp hour one that's in the current generation iPad 2. They're also claiming that Apple is going to actually release three different models of the iPad, actually two new ones and one old one. They're saying a mid and a high-end iPad 3 will be released, along with the current generation iPad 2 being continuing to be sold, but at a lower-end price point. The higher-end version is reportedly the one that will have the higher-end, larger battery, which could potentially extend its battery life up to 20 hours. I would assume that's actually the sort of theoretical and not real-world hour usage, but still, it's going to be a significant improvement over the current generation iPad 2. The other thing, though, that could impact battery life if Apple doesn't bump up the size of the battery is the fact that there's rumors the new units, the iPad 3s, will use quad-core A6 processors, and that's going to definitely suck up battery a little bit quicker. I would imagine they're also going to bump up the graphics to help drive the higher-end Retina displays that are being rumored. So Apple's going to have to do something on the battery front to even just continue with the existing battery life that you might get with an iPad 2. As far as Apple selling a lower-priced version of the iPad, continuing to sell the iPad 2, I think that's very likely to happen. We've seen Apple do that with the iPhones, and they've been very successful at it, bringing in an entry-level model. Brian Blair at Wedge Partners, says that we believe the iPad 2's price drop could drop to the $349 to $399 range, with Apple offering just a single 16-gigabyte model. The reports are saying that the lower-end iPad 2 could be Apple's response to the sort of popularity and growing sales rate of the Amazon Kindle Fire. I don't think that's the case. One, I don't think that the price, $349 to $399, is actually low enough to compete with the Kindle Fire. And frankly, I don't even think that Apple is considering themselves in the same league as the Kindle Fire. I think they see that as a lower-end entry-level tablet, and I think Apple sees the iPad at a different place than that. And that kind of goes along with my feeling that we've had these rumors of Apple doing a 7-inch iPad, sort of this iPad mini, again, I don't think that's going to happen, at least not this year. They're going to have to wait and see Kindle sales and 7-inch tablet sales really take off. Steve Jobs called those devices tweeners and non-starters, and I think Apple still believes in that philosophy. Now, moving back to the iPad 3 rumors, the one consistent rumor that we've had for months now is that Apple will upgrade the display to a Retina display running at a 2048 by 1536 pixel resolution with a dual LED backlit system. Again, another thing that if Apple has to go to dual backlighting, that's going to suck up a little bit more battery. And that's been kind of a concern about that rumor. Well, the latest word is that the display may use a different technology. It might not be the usual IPS panel that Apple goes with, but something new called an IGZO, indium gallium zinc oxide panel produced by Sharp. The IGZO, can we call them IGZOs or is it IGZO? I don't rightly know. The IGZO will supposedly offer near OLED power consumption rates at a much lower cost than OLEDs. I think they have to be a little bit thicker than the OLED panels, but still should be thin enough for Apple to squeeze into an iPad 3 design. Also, an advantage of the IGZO displays is that I guess they can be a little bit faster in terms of performance, and most importantly, would not necessarily require the dual LED backlighting, which is another area where Apple could gain a little bit on power savings. So I haven't heard too much about these displays. I'm going to have to dig in a little bit more and find out a little bit more about the technology. If you happen to know anything, shoot along a comment or an email, and we'll try and keep up to date on this one. But sounds like some interesting display technology that could find its way into the next generation of iPads. The DigiTimes rumors did kind of fall completely apart for me, though, when they claimed that Apple would be announcing the iPad 3 at the upcoming Macworld iWorld conference at the end of January. This is a show that Apple pulled out of a couple years ago. They're not coming back. Why anybody would think that that Apple would make an announcement at that show or even during that show is beyond me. Loop Insights' Jim Dalrymple, who this guy really knows his Apple stuff, been around in the industry for a long time, he reported almost immediately that these rumors were completely false, and I would trust his opinion and his site above DigiTimes almost any day of the week, especially when it comes to Apple rumors. So if you haven't ever checked out Loop Insight, it's a great blog and website, and you should really take a look at it and check it out. There's also rumors of a camera upgrade in the new iPad 3s, which I think would be a welcome addition. One of the areas I think the iPad 2 really suffers in is in terms of camera performance. The rumors are that there'd be a bump up to a 5 or 8 megapixel camera. I'm assuming that's the rear-facing camera, the one you use for taking pictures. And The Verge said that an iPad HD was in the works and would actually be able to run a new version, a touch-based version of Final Cut Pro. And so if you're going to do that, you're really going to want to have a higher quality camera that you can actually shoot some good HD video on and then do up some editing. And that would just be an amazing thing to see, to actually have a touch-based device that you can actually edit pro-level video on. And that could be an amazing demo and really drive some sales of some new iPad HD units, especially on the top-of-the-line one. And that gives a little bit credence, I think, to this rumor that there might be a mid-range and sort of a top-of-the-line iPad 3. I do believe that Apple is starting to wind down parts orders for the iPad 2. That was a rumor that we heard this week, that they're kind of slowing down iPad 2 parts orders and starting to prep for iPad 3 production, ramping up orders on that side. If they are going to continue to sell an iPad 2 at the lower end, they're going to continue to order parts, but they're obviously not going to need as many, especially if it's just the 16 gigabyte model. They can cut back on some of the flash or kind of redistribute that over to iPad 3 production. So I don't expect to hear an iPad announcement until February, maybe March, with the release following about a month later, 3 weeks to a month later. So if it happens in February, we'll see a launch in March. If we hear a announcement in March, probably a release of the iPad 3 starts shipping in April. There had been some rumors that it would happen earlier, that we might see iPad 3 coming out in February. I think actually February 24th, which I believe is Steve Jobs' birthday, was being thrown out as a date that Apple was pushing for. Again, I think that's complete conjecture. I don't think there's any evidence to really support that. And some of the other blogs and more respected sites that I've been reading kind of back that up. So I think Apple's going to stick to their yearly release cycle on things like the iPad and the iPhone and iPod updates and stuff like that. I don't see any reason for them to deviate from that, especially when there doesn't seem to be much competition in the market. The Amazon Fire has given them a little push, but I don't think they have to quite worry about the loss of market share in that area yet. But things are going to heat up in 2012. I think Apple's going to have to compete a little bit more in the tablet space, and I'm sure they have a game plan to do that. And the lower-end iPad 2, I think, is the first step towards actually having a model that'll compete with some of the lower-end offerings that'll be coming out in 2012. And then finally today, let's talk a little bit about how Apple did here at the end of the year, specifically related to the iPhone 4S and iPhone 4S sales and just their overall smartphone sales. The latest numbers came out from Comscore, and they show that Apple and Google both gained in U.S. smartphone market share from August to October. Apple's share actually rose just 1% from 27.1% to 28.1%. Android had a little bit more gain, going up 4.4% to grab 46.3% of the U.S. market. And while Apple's gains were a little bit more modest than Android's, the good news is that both companies made those gains at the expense of not each other, but actually at the expense of RIM and Microsoft, both of whom lost market share during the same period. The iPhone 4S also gave Apple their first ever jump into double-digit overall cell phone market sales in the U.S., with their share coming in at 10.8%, which was up about 1.3% from their previous showing. On a global level, the iPhone also gained smartphone market share in some markets worldwide, according to a piece over at Reuters. They're citing numbers from Kantar World Panel Comtech, and they say that iPhone smartphone share rose year over year in Australia and was up about 10% year over year in the UK. Apple didn't fare quite as well in some of the other European markets. They were actually down about 9% in France from 29% to 20%. Down slightly in Germany from 27% to 22%, and had similar drops in Italy and Spain. One thing I noted when I was reading through these pieces is that many of those markets, specifically Germany and France, were some areas where Apple has been embroiled in some various lawsuits. So I have to wonder if the slight decline didn't have something to do with maybe some of the press, which tends to be a little bit negative when you're involved in lawsuits in different countries. It sours people to your brand. So that might be a little bit of that problem. I don't know how much that is or if it's some other factor. If you're in one of those regions and have maybe a little insight, you know, we don't cover too much international on the MacCast, and I'm hoping to do a little bit more. So I'm trying to include some more stories like this for you. It'd be nice to know from someone in the region specifically what's going on in terms of iPhone smartphone share. I mean, overall here at the end of the year, Apple is doing very well. Their stock's up. They're very profitable compared to some of the other companies that have been struggling in this past year. I think they're in a very good place moving into 2012. And, of course, you can't win them all. Apple will continue to do some battle and bring out some new innovative products. I'm looking forward to 2012, as I'm sure you are. Actually, this is a good little homework assignment. Why don't, if you get an inkling, send in a comment, an email about what you expect to see from Apple in 2012 or what you're excited to see from Apple in 2012, and maybe we can get a little conversation going here on the MacCast. So that's going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, let me take a quick moment, thank another one of our show sponsors, Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. You know, I've talked to you a lot about Notebook. One thing that I thought maybe I'd try to do is give you some examples of how you can use Notebook and maybe some tips and tricks on how the product might fit into your lifestyle. And number one example that came to mind when I was thinking about this was doing some research. It is a great tool for doing research, and one of the big features that I like in doing research with Notebook is the clipping feature. So let's say you were going to do a research paper on Steve Jobs. You might set up a Steve Jobs notebook and then set up various sections within that notebook, maybe a section called Early Days, Apple, Next, Pixar, and you divide those in with different dividers and tabs just like you would in a real notebook. And then within a page on each one of those, you can go to a page and you can add a clipping service. So you add the clipping service, and once you've done that, you'll get a little scissors icon near the title to indicate that that now has a clipping service attached to it. And what a clipping service does for you is you can now go into Safari, into Mail, almost any OS X application, make a selection, and then if you go under the Apple menu under services, you're going to see the notebook clippings, and you'll be able to clip whatever you have selected into your notebook, all without leaving the app that you're working in. So you can browse through Safari, do all your research, and start clipping things off to the various sections. And when you do that, you will see a scissors icon appear over the notebook icon. You'll hear a little snip sound, and that way you know it worked. And then anything that was in that selection gets included in that notebook. That includes text and images, all the formatting, any hyperlinks that might be in there. So now when you're all done doing your research and compiling everything, you go back into Notebook, you open it up, and you go to that page, and you'll see all your clippings, and they'll have a little scissor icon. Notebook actually calls them little stickers in the margin. And if you click and hold on that sticker, you get some various options depending upon where you did the original clipping from. So you can do things like clean up any of the wrapping or the formatting. If the clipping came from Safari, it actually has a snapback feature, so you can actually go back to the original source URL if you need to go back and re-reference something or maybe get some more details or information. If the clipping came from something like Mail, you have the ability to copy the sender's address, you can show the original email, or you can reply directly to the sender. So just with one click, start a reply to the person that you clip that from. And then there's also an info section that'll show you the date of that email, the sender's name, and the email address, along with the subject of the source email. So a lot of information can be compiled into your notebook, and you can move easily back and forth. And if you add a clipping service to a divider page, there's a bonus feature that Notebook will create a new note page within your notebook every time you add a clipping. So if you'd prefer to have each clipping on its own page, you can do that automatically simply by adding the original clipping service to one of the dividers. And that's just one of the tons of features and options that are available in Notebook. So I encourage you to go check it out. You can download a free trial. You can try it out for yourself. And it's a great product. CircusPonies.com is where you'll find it. And a big thank you to Circus Ponies for their continued support of the MacCast. So as I was browsing through all the articles and blogs and stuff for in prepping for this episode, you know, there's a lot of people doing sort of end of the year type stories, 2011 polls and things like that. And I ran across one related to Android owners. It was actually an infographic that was trying to analyze, you know, the anatomy of an Android owner. What do they look like? Who are they? And they called this guy Mr. Android. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com if you want to see the actual infographic. But it was done by this company called BlueStacks, and they used data from Nielsen and also supposedly their 145,000 Facebook fans interviewed them and asked Android owners different factoids. And they came up with things like 71% of them wear t-shirts, or 38% of them use an Android device for work. But what really caught my eye in the story, and I think I had heard this number before, I think it probably came from the Nielsen data, was that 33%, so a third of Android owners, have zero paid applications on their device. And I started thinking about that, and I thought, you know, I don't know if I know a single iOS owner, somebody with an iPod Touch or an iPhone or an iPad, that has absolutely zero paid applications on their device. And that's a significant thing. I think it's kind of a big deal. If you're a developer and you're trying to decide what platform you're going to come out on, you're going to bring your application out on, you're going to want to go to the place where you can actually make some money and people are buying applications. So it does come into consideration. You know, not every developer has the resources to develop for multiple platforms at once. So if you're forced into that position of which platform am I going to launch on, you're going to go where you have people buying your applications. And when you see a number like that, that's going to weigh into your decision. And it becomes important because I think even more than on the PC, the available applications that are out for the device can influence the buying decisions on mobile devices like phones and tablets. People buy I think these devices for very specific reasons, very often for one specific application, maybe something that you saw demoed, you saw in an ad, a buddy showed you, maybe a specific application that you need for work. And if that application is not available on that device, you're going to look for the device that has that app. So I don't know, maybe I'm crazy. I'm curious to know what you think. I'm also very curious to know if there's any of you out there that have absolutely zero paid applications on your iOS device. I think it'd be very hard to not have at least one 99-cent app on your device. But who knows? Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there's more of you out there with zero paid apps than I think. You certainly can do a lot with free apps and some of the freemium apps. And I think freemium apps still fall into that free category. So those are the ones where you can get the application for free. You can get most of its functionality, but then maybe you need to buy some upgrades in the app. I'm thinking specifically about like some of the Zynga games and things like that, Farmville or Wii Rule, where you have paid in-app things that you can do. But those are still, I think, considered free apps. I really want to know, have you ever not paid? Do you have a device and you have zero paid apps? So send me some feedback, and we'll try and follow up on that in a future episode. Another thing that I saw recently was that some of my apps apparently are dirty, and I don't mean dirty like adult applications. Not all of them, but some of them. TI Book or TIBP, I think it's TI Book, which is a blog, had an article that pointed out that since iOS 5 came out, occasionally on your device, you might see the word cleaning appear under your application icon in iOS. Now, I haven't personally noticed this yet, but I've seen screenshots and I know that it can happen. It's very similar to the way you might see the word downloading or installing when you're doing an update or first installing an application. And what is actually going on, in case you weren't aware, is that iOS 5, because it now allows you to back up to iCloud, and just in general for speeding up backups on the desktop, Apple decided that they wanted to slim down any extraneous data. They didn't want to back up anything that they didn't need to back up. And so the iOS system will now occasionally purge out any temporary or cached data that may be in an application to save space before performing those backups. So you're more likely to see it in some sort of application that has offline data, but it's data that it doesn't necessarily need to save, something that could be re-downloaded or pulled back down from the web or some other location. And examples would include things like the Facebook app, Instapaper, Wikipedia, some of the podcast apps where you might have offline playback of podcasts, although depending upon how those are implemented, that may actually put it in more persistent storage area. It all sounds fine and good, like it's not going to be a problem. You know, this is temporary data. You can re-download it. But Marco Armont, the developer of Instapaper, kind of commented on this, and he wrote a great piece on his blog about maybe some of the potential gotchas in this new system. And I'll have a link to that in the show notes at maccast.com. But getting kind of into the nitty-gritty, the way it works is every iOS application has its own kind of home directory where it can store data. This is part of that whole kind of sandboxing system, and it has specific locations where it can put stuff. And every file in the home directory gets backed up when you do a sync to iTunes or now when you back up to iCloud. Everything in that home directory gets backed up except for stuff that's in two locations. And that's a temp folder, a TMP directory, or a caches directory. Those places are supposed to be for developers to put data that is not persistent, stuff that they need to have cached, but that can then maybe be re-downloaded from another location. So things like files, anything that needs to be persistent, is supposed to be stored in a documents folder within that home folder. And that's the location where if you're working on a document within a application and you're disconnected, that's where it's going to pull that information from. Apparently, Apple started cracking down on developers who started to store too much data in that documents folder. And specifically, some developers are storing data in there that could actually be recreated or re-downloaded by the app. And they've been putting it in that documents folder to avoid this kind of cache cleansing or this throwing away of files. So if you're doing the right thing, and Instapaper has apparently been doing the right thing for all along. They've been storing stuff in the cache folder. The thing is prior to iOS 5, that didn't get cleared out. The system wasn't going through and kind of purging that stuff. So developers could still be fairly certain that that data was going to be there. Apple actually defines this for developers pretty clearly in their documentation. They distinguish the two storage locations like this. They say only documents and other data that is generated by the user generated or cannot otherwise be recreated by your application should be stored in the application home documents directory. Data that can be downloaded again or regenerated should be stored in the application home /library/caches directory. So developers who are doing it right run into this potential problem that, you know, the cleaning can occur and be triggered almost any time, say, by an event where storage is getting low. And the user may or may not know that that data is getting purged. And if you're in a situation, say, where you're getting ready for a flight, say you're at an airport, you have Instapaper, you're thinking, oh, I'm going to want to read some Instapaper articles before I get on the plane. So I'm going to go ahead while I'm on Wi-Fi, I'm going to download all of those articles. Oh, and then I'm going to grab a couple iBooks and download some music from iCloud. And, oh, I want a couple of movies. Let me buy this movie. That last action, say purchasing that movie, the movie's downloading, it needs some extra space, it's looking around, where am I going to get some extra space? Oh, you know, Instapaper has all this stuff in cache. Let's purge that out, and then I can store my movie. So unbeknownst to you, you now get on the plane, you're getting ready to read your Instapaper stuff that you had downloaded while you were on Wi-Fi in the airport for offline reading, and it's not there. And you're not really understanding why it's not there, you just think that Instapaper was broken or errored, and you now start emailing the developer and saying, hey, what's going on? You know, you're not, I can't get my cache data, or my data's not caching. Well, that is what's happening. You know, iOS is kind of cleaning up after itself. So I don't know that there's a real solution for that, but it was something that I thought you should be aware of. And if you've ever seen that cleaning thing, you now know what's going on. And maybe if you've run into the situation where you thought you had data cached within an application and it's suddenly not there, you now know why that's happening also. So I'm sure many of you probably got new iOS devices for the holidays, and maybe a feature that you've been curious or interested in checking out is iTunes Match. We've talked a little bit about iTunes Match on the show. When Apple released it, they kind of released it without any real information and kind of figuring out how to make it work, how iTunes in the cloud fit in, how iTunes fit in, how your iOS devices fit in is a little bit confusing. And finally, I think Apple realized that this past week or so, they recently released a new FAQ page on their website to help explain things a little bit better. So if you go to apple.com/iTunes/iTunes Match, I think it is. I'll have a link directly to it in the show notes. But if you go there and scroll down a little bit, you'll see the kind of 1, 2, 3, this is how you use iTunes Match stuff, followed by a couple different facts, and you can read through that. But I got a specific question from Andrew this week, and he wanted to know, you know, how do you manage the downloaded content on your iOS devices when you're using iTunes Match? You know, what happens when you run out of space? How do you control how much music is actually downloaded directly on your device, say when you're listening on shuffle? Like, I like to listen on shuffle mode. Once you turn on iTunes Match, everything is in the cloud. But when you're on your iOS devices and you're listening to music, it's actually downloading each track kind of in the background as it's playing. It's kind of this progressive download thing. It's not a true streaming. So every song that you play is going to be eating up a little bit of space on your device. And the question is, you know, what happens when the thing fills up? How do I get rid of content? How do I manage that sort of stuff? So I started thinking about this a little bit, and it's really not all that clear. So what happens, if you've never seen it before, is there's a little iCloud icon next to the tracks on your iOS devices when they're not stored locally, when they're up in the cloud and haven't been through this kind of progressive download process yet. And you can click on that icon and download the track, or like I said, if it's just playing on shuffle and you hit a track that hasn't been downloaded, it's going to download automatically in the background. You can also go into your playlists and albums and things like that and scroll all the way down to the bottom, and there'll be a download all these tracks option. You can do that for an artist, I think, as well. So you can start pulling down content. And I believe by default, when it's first turned on, you only can download over Wi-Fi. If you want to be able to download over 3G, you're going to want to go into the settings under the store settings and then turn on the use cellular data option. So that may or may not be on if you've turned that on in the past, but I think by default, Apple doesn't have that turned on because they don't want you to go over your data limit when you're suddenly, you know, downloading a bunch of content in the background and you may not even realize that you're actually downloading it. If there isn't a little cloud icon next to the track, again, that means that it's already downloaded. It's stored locally. And I believe that once your device kind of fills up, and I don't know where I read this. I couldn't find confirmation on this. I'm pretty sure I read this someplace that was legitimate, that when your device fills up and you're running out of space, iTunes Match will sort of automatically purge out older tracks, and it does it supposedly in a smart way where it's going to analyze stuff that was least recently listened to and try and purge out that stuff first and make room for the new stuff that you're downloading. As far as actually trying to figure out how much storage your music is using up, if you can, you can go into the settings on your iOS device, go under General, go into Usage, and then you'll see a music section. You can click on that and you can see, oh, music is taking up, you know, 2.2 gigabytes or 4 gigabytes or however much space. Doesn't really tell you much more than that. It does, I think, list for podcasts and some specific content how much space each one of those is using up, but it doesn't really break out your music in terms of, like, this playlist uses this much storage and what have you. So give you a slight indication of how much space your music's using up, but not a whole lot of specifics. The last thing, I guess, that you can do in terms of managing your content right on your device that I think some people don't know about is you can actually delete a track right out of the music app simply by swiping over it. I always go from left to right. I think from right to left might work as well. But, you know, you swipe over it like you want to cross it out, and then you get the little delete button, and you can actually delete it. And this works for movies and TV shows, any content that is on your iOS device in the music app, I think you can do this with. And you, once you've deleted it, if you're using iTunes Match, again, remember, this is all related to using iTunes Match. If you're using iTunes Match and you delete a track, then the cloud icon will reappear, and you could, of course, re-download that track from the cloud. But that would get it off your device and free up that storage in case you are actually running out of space. And the nice thing is this also works for whole albums or artists. So if you go into the album view or the artist view and do the same thing, swipe your finger over, hit the delete button, it will delete all the tracks related to that album or artist, and that'll help you free up space. It didn't seem to work for me on all my playlists. It's kind of was hit or miss when I tried to do that on playlists, but you can play around with that, and that may help you out a little bit. The one thing that there isn't that I think maybe there needs to be, and I think, Andrew, this is what you were trying to allude to, is some sort of way to define a maximum or a minimum amount of space that the music app can use or use up for storage so that it's not kind of running over and taking up all your available space. But I think the way Apple thinks about it is that it will auto-purge and kind of free up space to use up the available space that's sitting on your device. I can imagine, though, that, you know, you've downloaded a bunch of music and now you want to go download some new app and your device is telling you you're out of space. Well, you're going to either have to end up deleting apps or going into the music thing and deleting different tracks and albums and content and stuff like that. And of course you can do it, but it's not a real clean process or an easy process to go through. So yeah, I think Apple has a little bit more thought to do through the iTunes Match thing, specifically with managing content on your devices. But that should give you some ideas of some tips and tricks and things that you can do related to that. And I don't know, I think last week we had quite a few iTunes questions, and it's happening again this week. So I'm not sure if it's related to everybody getting new devices for the holidays or what's going on. But I received another question from Mackay about iTunes and how to control it from the keyboard.
Hi, Adam. I noticed there's been a bit of a theme going on in regards to iTunes and the Mac and ways to control it and modify it. So I am here to ask a question about how to bind iTunes functionality to function keys on a non-Apple keyboard. Specifically, I have a Mac Ali full-size keyboard. It includes functions F1 through F15 and a full-size numpad. But it does not have the Apple play, pause, previous track, next track buttons that are included on Apple keyboards and on the Apple keyboards that are built into their MacBooks and MacBook Airs. So my problem is when I plug in my MacBook to my cinema display, I close the lid, there's no way for me, when I'm in other applications, to quickly play, pause, next track, or previous track within iTunes without having to navigate back to iTunes, click on the play, pause button, and then have it work that way. I've tried playing around in system preferences. I've tried playing around with some of those hotkey things, and I've even looked through some of the help files within iTunes and have had no luck figuring out a way to do this. So ideally, I would like to have F13 mapped to previous track, F14 mapped to play pause, and F15 mapped to next track. And if you were someone in the community, you could help me figure this out. That would be awesome.
Okay, well, I'm going to try and help you figure this out, although you mentioned in there that you had tried potentially some of the solutions that I'm going to recommend to you. The very first thing that I thought of was, well, yeah, I don't know a built-in way of actually doing this. I don't think there's any way you can actually map keys from a third-party keyboard to iTunes, to the iTunes controls, in a built-in way. I do think that there's some third-party keyboards out there. I think I had a Kensington keyboard that actually had the media playback controls built into it and actually did work sort of out of the box, although it may have required using their software to actually do the mappings, or their drivers may have handled that functionality. So you might check and see if there is software for your keyboard. Generally with Macs, you don't have to install the third-party software, and I, a lot of times, unless there's a specific reason, don't recommend that people do. But if there's advanced features or the ability to sort of map some of the keys or function keys, that might be built into the driver software, and you may need to install that and configure it through the system preferences. So that would be one thing to try out. I don't think that's the case with your specific keyboard. So barring that, the two options that I could think of would be to get some sort of global key mapping software and use that, or use some sort of heads-up display control type application or menu bar application. And there's a couple of different solutions in the different categories. The one that I ran across as I was doing research for this show, and again, I don't have your specific keyboard, so I have all Apple keyboards, so whether or not you can see and map the higher-end F keys, like you mentioned, I think F13 through F15 or 16, something like that. I don't have a keyboard with those keys on it, so I don't know if these solutions will work or not. But I ran across Sizzling Keys, which is a system preference pane, and it also offers a heads-up display. But the thing about it is it does allow you to map keys globally, and they have a free version. And you can also upgrade to a pro version, which gives you some advanced features. But all the basic features that you're talking about in terms of play, pause, and next previous track can be had in the free version of the app. And it allows you to go in and assign specific keys to those functions. So I can't imagine that you wouldn't be able to assign the keys that you want. And I'll have a link to that in the show notes at maccast.com. Somewhat related to that, there's a couple other applications that have global key mapping for specifically for iTunes controls. One is a cool menu bar app that I've used in the past called Synergy. I think it costs around €5. And that one works particularly well and will let you map hotkeys to control iTunes. And another really nice one that's available in the App Store, it has a really nice heads-up display and some features for showing an icon in the dock and also for displaying album art on your desktop and bringing up a heads-up display and menu bar controls. So a lot of features in this one. It's called Cover Sutra. And that's available in the Mac App Store. And again, I'll have a link to all these in the show notes at maccast.com. So that's certainly one way to go. Oh, I guess real quickly, another thing, speaking of dock icons, one thing you could do if you don't mind clicking, I know we're specifically talking about keyboard controls, but something I often forget about is that when iTunes is running, if you just go over to the dock and right-click or control-click on the dock icon, you do get pop-ups for iTunes controls. So you can play pause and next previous track and get some other information through the dock icon. So that's, I guess, kind of a third option, but not generally related to keyboard controls, which I think is what you're going for. So the other thing that you could do is you could use a more general heads-up control application, something like Alfred, which allows you to, through a keyboard stroke, I think the default is option spacebar, bring up a little pop-up window, and then you can actually type iTunes commands directly in it. Now, to get that feature in Alfred, you need to buy what's called a power pack. So Alfred, the Alfred app is free. It's alfredapp.com if you want to check it out. And it's, I think it's available on the app store as well. But to get the iTunes controls, you have to kind of upgrade in app or get an additional license. And that's £15. Of course, meaning British pounds sterling, the money doesn't actually weigh 15 pounds. but that little piece of software will allow you to control iTunes by typing in commands. So you can say play and then type the name of a track, or I think type next or previous in the heads up control, and then hit return, and it'll actually, or a hotkey, and it'll actually control iTunes. The nice thing about something like Alfred is it actually controls more than just iTunes. You can do a whole lot of stuff with it. It's kind of like if you've ever used Quicksilver. It's an application launcher. It allows you to type commands to perform different functions on your machine. So you can say, bring up the heads up control and say email Adam, and it'll start generating an email. Within the Mail app, you can copy and paste and move files around with it. You can do a lot of stuff through keyboard controls through the Alfred application. I just started playing around with it and exploring it a little bit, and it's pretty neat. So you may want to just check that one out as an aside. As far as how all these applications worked in terms of specifically iTunes control, the thing that you're looking for, my favorite one was the sizzling keys. I thought it was the most general. It offered a free version, and I think it'll give you the functionality that you need. So check that out. Hopefully that works. I'm sure some of you in the community have a recommendation for Mackay. If you do, send me an email, and we'll try and follow up on future episodes. And in addition to getting some new hardware, I'm sure many of us bought some new applications over the holiday season. I got an email from Joseph, and he had just purchased a bunch of new iOS apps for his new iPhone 4S, and had what I think is a very good question about the future, specifically related to the rumors of the new Retina iPad 3 and needing to get applications that would support the new higher resolution display. You know, he was wondering, are the apps that I'm buying now going to be able to run on the new device? Am I going to have to buy new versions? And, you know, the answer is a little bit tricky. It mostly depends on Apple and the developers. So the one thing I think we're going to have to do is assume that Apple is going to go the double resolution route, as is being rumored, and put out a 2048 by 1536 pixel display. If they do that, they should be able to offer the 2X option like they did when they moved to the Retina display iPhone, so that existing applications could run in a small window on the new iPad 3 at the current iPad iPhone 4S resolution, and then you could hit a 2X option and blow it up where it would just double the pixels. It's not going to look all that great on the Retina display. You're going to get some pixelation, but you'll still be able to have it full screen, and it won't be distorted. Everything will look right. So you can have that running on your new HD iPad 3. So I think that's going to be out of the gate the solution for current generation apps. After that, it would be up to developers to then update their existing applications with new higher res graphics to support the higher resolution display. I have to imagine that some of the developers are already starting to count on and maybe even start to prep and build in those assets so that early on, they'll be able to update their applications very quickly to support a new HD iPad 3. The thing about it is, it's really at the developer's discretion at that point whether or not they want to push those updates for free within their existing applications or make new iPad 3 versions of their apps, new iPad HD versions of their apps, and sell those and require an actual extra purchase. Also, Joseph was mentioning that he was buying these applications for the iPhone 4S. I'm assuming that all the apps that you purchased are already universal applications and would support both the iPhone and the iPad. When developers put out new versions of their iPad apps, if they already have a separate iPad version that's separate from the iPhone version, then you would still need to repurchase the iPad version of that app in order to be able to get the upgrades or any new graphics that support an iPad 3. And for any of you who don't know, when you're buying apps, how you can tell if it's a universal app or not, when you're on the App Store, right under the buy icon, there'll be a little plus icon. And that's your indicator that it will run both in native resolutions on an iPhone and on an iPad. The requirements, and I've gotten caught in this trap before, where I've had an app and I've just looked at the system requirements and it says it supports the iPad. That is not always enough to indicate that they actually have an iPad native version. You need to look for that little plus icon that indicates it is supported on both devices. If it just says it's an iPhone app and it also supports the iPad, it could just mean that it's going to run at that, you know, little window or 2x resolution, which in my mind really isn't iPad support. So if you want the full native graphics, make sure that you're getting the universal iPad apps. And Joseph, I hope that answers your question. So really, we don't really know. My guess is that most developers are going to support the new resolution. They're going to push out new assets. And if you already have a universal application, you're going to get those updates most likely for free. You know, probably 80, 85, 90% of the time, that seems to be the route that developers go. But be prepared that you may need to rebuy some of your apps to get the higher res versions that'll run on a new iPad 3. Received an interesting question from listener David through a voicemail. Unfortunately, the audio quality was a little bit too low to play for you, but he called in and he wanted to know if there was a way to export iTunes metadata, things like the play count, the track length, the track names, etc., from iTunes, and he needed something that would actually work on a Windows machine. He hopes to be a Mac user soon, but hasn't been able to make the leap quite yet. And we have a lot of you who are in that situation. You're considering getting your first Mac and still having to work on Windows machines. Maybe you have an iPad or an iPhone, and that's fine. David was a little bit worried in his email, or sounded a little bit worried in his email, that we wouldn't cover his question, but certainly I want to help you out. And the good news is that it's a fairly easy thing to do. And this solution turns out to be universal and requires nothing more than iTunes itself, which is available on Mac and Windows. So this is going to work for Mac users as well as Windows users, and that's always a good tip. So all you need to do is actually open up iTunes and then control or right-click on any one of the libraries in the left-hand column there. Actually, any one of the libraries except for apps or tones, ringtones, this will work for. It will also even work for playlists. And when you do that, you'll notice there's an option that says export. When you select the export option, it'll open up a file save dialog window. And you can select from a format dropdown a bunch of different formats to export the data in. And you can export it in plain text, Unicode text, XML, M3U, or M3U8. And those last two are playlist file formats. And then give it a name and save it. So in your case, you're going to want to export as a text file, just a plain text, or you could use Unicode. I just use plain text when I do this. And when you do that, you're going to end up with a tab delineated text file that has all of the information for that library. So if you're exporting your music library, it's going to have all your music information that's in iTunes. And then you can take that tab delineated text file and import it into an application like Numbers or Excel if you want to filter it and work with it further. So the resulting file actually contains columns for the name, the artist, composer, album, grouping, genre, size, time, disc number, disc count, year, date modified, date added, bit rate, sample rate, volume adjustments, the media kind, meaning music, audiobook, podcast, movie, that sort of thing. The equalizer settings or values, the comments, the plays, which is the play count, the last played, the number of skips, the last skipped rating, and the location, meaning the file location on your Mac or, in your case, your Windows PC. So a lot of metadata in there. You can export it all, and you can get it into an Excel spreadsheet fairly easily, and that's how you do it. So Hope that helps you out, David, and good luck in getting your new Mac. I hope that happens real soon. And then finally, for the last episode of the MacCast for the year, I have a fix or a potential fix for some of you related to mail and using Exchange Server. I know there's many of you out there that use Exchange along with your Macs and Apple Mail. And Richie sent me an issue that he was having with OS X Mail and his Exchange accounts. According to him, he was having an issue where he has a lot of Microsoft Exchange accounts attached to Mail, mail.app, and Mail would suddenly start to use up all his available memory. He said sometimes going over 2 gigs of memory at times after being open for about 30 minutes. And he was trying to troubleshoot the problem, doing some searching, and it didn't yield very many results or solutions. One recommendation was actually to reboot the Mac into safe mode and delete any large messages that might be in the mail client, but that didn't seem to help. And what he discovered is that if you just go into mail.app and select the mailbox, you can choose rebuild under the mailbox menu, and for him, it resolved the issue. So if you've been running into an issue where you're connecting to an Exchange server and mail is eating up a lot of your memory, you might want to try this trick. Rebuilding your mailbox should generally be a safe operation, but I definitely would recommend making sure that you have a full backup of all your mail in your mailboxes before trying this. Of course, if you're using an Exchange server, all the mail should already be stored on the server, but just in case, make sure that you have good backups. And what's actually happening is that mail keeps an index file sort of responsible for displaying the content in your inbox. And I would assume that that's somehow becoming corrupt or getting out of sync. It might be getting bloated. It might have duplicate data in it. I don't know specifically what's going on, but probably something's happening to that file since this, as Richie pointed out, this seemed to fix it, or the rebuilding. And rebuilding that index could kind of go through and just clean up things. It'll actually restore the index file kind of back to new. And the good thing about this tip is it could be helpful also if you're just having general issues with mail.app, if you've had situations where you're missing emails or you're having slow searching, or maybe some of your email messages are coming up slowly, like you click on a message and it takes a while for it to appear, you might just try rebuilding the mailbox and see if that helps just with general performance. If you do have larger mailboxes, so if you have a lot of stuff in your inbox and you do this rebuilding, it could take a little bit of time. So just be aware of that. And if you kind of want to watch the progress, if you go under the window menu and select activity, bring up the activity window, you can kind of see what's happening with the rebuild process as you're doing that. So thanks, Richie, for sending in that tip. I'm sure it's going to help some of our users who are on Exchange servers. So that's going to do it for this episode. I'm going to talk to you again in 2012. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors, Pharonix, makers of Deep Freeze. You can check out their software. Get more information and details over at pharonix.com. Circus Ponies, try out Notebook. You can get a free trial as well as more information. They have some great video tutorials on how to use the product over at circusponies.com. And Smile. SmileSoftware.com is the place where you can check out all their great apps, Text Expander, Disk Label, PDF Pen, love them all. Try them out, and a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. A huge, huge big thank you to you for listening to the show, staying subscribed, being part of the MacCast community. I love getting your emails and your audio comments. Please keep sending those in. Let me know what you want to hear about on the show. You can send those to maccast@gmail.com, or you can call in on the listener hotline, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9, and leave your voicemail messages there. Also, if you're on Skype, you can leave voicemail on Skype, and that address is the MacCast. Be sure to check out the maccast.com website. There you'll find show notes with links to everything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast. That's at maccast.com, and while you're there, be sure to check out the MacCast forum, forum.maccast.com, and check out the MacCast Facebook page. That's a place where I try, just as I'm doing research, I run across interesting Mac-related videos, Apple stories, stuff that I find of interest that maybe isn't going to make it into the show, kind of the extra stuff, little bonus things. I tend to throw those up on Facebook or maybe on the Twitter stream. So you can check those two things out, facebook.com/TheMacCast, or just follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. So thank you again for being a part of the MacCast community in 2011. Have a happy, safe, wonderful new year, and we'll catch you back here in 2012. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.